Football Weekly Extra from The Guardian in association with sportingbet.com.
Football Weekly Extra. Today, midweek madness in the Carling Cup semi-finals while Villa are now through to the final. Tevez and City take first blood at Eastlands, leaving the second leg now as interest-laden as United themselves. Meanwhile, in the league, Arsenal go top of the table while at Anfield, Dirk Kuyt grabs a brace. You can count the number of times that's happened on the fingers of Gary Neville's hand. We have a comprehensive roundup of the continent, France, Germany, Spain, Italy, and the African Cup of Nations, which are on to the quarterfinals if you haven't been paying attention, plus your post and a little look forward to the weekend's FA Cup action. All of that on today's Football Weekly Extra. Hi, everybody on board today. It's Paul Doyle.
Hi, James. How are you?
I'm very well, Paul, but how are you good. Back from your lengthy absence?
Yeah, I'm good.
Barry Glendenning, hello.
How are you?
I'm very well, actually. I refer you to my previous answer. And yourself, Barry, honed and buffed from the gym?
Well, not really, no.
You were spotted, though, in the gym.
By who?
Hang on a second. I've got the... This man here, Alan something, says...
This is slightly disturbing.
Alan Sinop, freaky experiences in the gym. So there I was doing a little gentle lifting and laughing at Barry's story on the pod about the chap in his hometown lighting cigars with tennis. When who should walk in but the big G himself? Apparently you didn't fancy the weight, opted instead for a determined-looking bout of cross-training. Interesting.
All right. Do you know what? Actually, this could have been really... I think I know the guy in question, and I was actually listening to Football Weekly while I was on the cross trainer.
Wow.
That would have been really embarrassing.
Indeed. Rafa Honigstein.
Hello.
How do you keep fit, Rafa?
I don't.
Oh. Now, crazy midweek of action. Should we start with the League Cup and this fantastic City-United game? A Real Madrid posting in saying the best two games I've seen from the UK this season have been from United and City, and he's looking forward to the... Or he or she are looking forward to the next one already. It was a cracking match, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was a good game. Had a bit of everything, you know, good goals, controversy, fan tomfoolery, and Carlos Tevez, obviously, you know, sort of sticking it to Sir Alex Ferguson and Gary Neville in a sort of, how dare you have sold me. He's obviously quite bitter about it still. I'm not sure why, because he earns £7 million a year and he's doing fine.
If you were going out with a girl and she insisted every time she saw her previous boyfriend on waving at him and pointing at you and flashing diamond rings in previous boyfriend's direction, wouldn't you be a little bit concerned about her mindset?
Well, I would be very concerned right. about her mindset. I don't think that's a situation would ever arise.
Right.
I think I'd probably feel more sorry for her ex if I was a step up.
Really?
Yeah. But, yeah, it's poor form, I think. But it's all pantomime and it's funny and it's entertaining.
So. It does pave the way, though, for humiliation next week if things don't go to Tevez's cunning plan at Old Trafford.
Yeah. Indeed so. It's... It's far from over this time.
Yeah, I mean, judging by the last 10 minutes, which was the only minute of the match that I saw, right. City were on the ropes, and Wayne Rooney was absolutely fantastic in that last 10 minutes. He was brilliant. He was genuinely world class. The panic that he sowed in the City defence every time he got the ball was quite thrilling to behold.
Mm. And, world class without actually scoring the goal that they needed.
Yeah.
He was sensational. Mm-hmm. He was really unbelievable. It was probably one of the best games I've seen from him in a long, long time.
Really?
It was a strange match in that way, because I think United probably did enough first in the first half hour and then in the last 20 minutes or so to win the game comfortably, but they didn't. Mm-hmm. So I would still make them small favourites to go through as well.
United?
Yes.
Yeah. Ferguson will presumably be taking the second leg very, very seriously indeed.
I mean, it's a bit of a headache for him because, you know, with the fixtures that they've got coming up, Arsenal away, etc., he wouldn't have really wanted to play the best team in this game or in the next one indeed, and now you'll really have to go for it again, and for somebody like Rooney who runs around a lot and maybe too much, it's a problem.
Interesting. Barry.
Yes.
Tevez.
Yeah.
Neville.
Well, Gary Neville's sort of in trouble for giving Carlos Tevez the finger when Carlos Tevez sort of went yaboo sucks to him. There was also trouble with the fans. Apparently, the stewards were frisking a lot of fans going into the ground, and they found some Manchester United fans with golf balls and darts. And so there's a possibility, obviously, that they were planning a round of golf or a game of darts after the match. But
right.
The stewards suspected otherwise, so I think they were kicked out.
Well, as you say, it's going to be a heated occasion next week when the two sides meet again at Old Trafford. Meantime, already through to the final at Wembley, Aston Villa, after an extraordinary semi-final with Blackburn Rovers, who were a bit miffed. Big Sam Allardyce with the refereeing. I didn't see the game myself.
Big Sam Allardyce in miffed with referee sensation.
Mm-hmm. Indeed.
I didn't see this game either. I was sort of annoyed I missed it, but quite pleased, because if I'd been doing the minute-by-minute report, that would have been quite traumatic.
Producer Pete comes to our rescue here by reporting that whilst it was a frenetic affair involving 10 goals, it was a scrappy do at best. Although he says Olsen scored a wonderful overhead kick and Ashley Young's goal was good, so there you go. Okay, good. You didn't see it, Barry, because you were doing the minute-by-minute on Liverpool's big, big win over their rivals for fourth place, Spurs.
Yeah.
Go on, then. One point off fourth now. City, though, in fifth, do have a game in hand in that particular race. But what of Liverpool? Turning point? New dawn?
Oh, God, every time they play a game, they're either in crisis, out of crisis, you know.
What about Spurs then? Are they in crisis? You had the 0-0 with Hull at the weekend. They've been whomped by United, Chelsea and Arsenal. And even this Liverpool can put two past them.
Yeah, I mean, Liverpool are by far and away the better team. And the only thing that stopped it being a rout was their inability to put away chances. Spurs did score a goal just after half-time, which was ruled out, and I'm still not sure if it was ruled out for being offside, in which case it shouldn't have been ruled out, or for a foul by Jermaine Defoe on Pepe Reina. But Liverpool were workmanlike, but Spurs were abject, and they offered nothing. And I think, I wouldn't say they're in crisis, but they're sort of mini slump is entirely predictable, and I've said before that I fully expect them to slide down the table, and it looks like that slide has begun.
Hmm.
As a neutral, I find it quite depressing that Liverpool would probably still finish fourth after having this terrible of a season, and that there is no one in the Premier League decent enough to take that fourth spot, even against one of the worst Liverpool sides in the last 5-6 years.
Owen Coyle at Bolton. Is it just a coincidence that they roared off to this 2-0 lead at the Emirates Wednesday night? You were there, Raphael. Are they playing better now, the Trousers?
They're trying to play football, which is good news and bad news.
Yeah.
Because I think it's going to be difficult playing that system, that style, and surviving at the same time. I think they're in trouble. He does look... on call, does look a bit like George Clooney's trailer trash brother. But he's no fan of up in the air.
No.
So I'm not sure that's a good thing though for Bolton.
Rotten,
I think they're trying to be too cultured,
right,
for their own good. And you know, Arsenal looked really sluggish, complacent the first half an hour. Danielson was by far Bolton's best player. He was really, really terrible. But sort of the two thirds after that of the game, the last 60 minutes of the game, it was just Arsenal and Bolton kind of raised the white flag.
But they were a little bit upset over the assault. William Gallas on Mark Davis.
And well, they can be upset.
Mm.
They can be upset with the referee for not spotting it.
Mm.
But then not many people did, I think, at the time in the stadium. It was only at the repeat. And
that the because Arsenal, the tackle was so late?
Yeah, well, maybe. The Arsenal... Yeah, it was so late that the game had already moved on. Yeah, that's right. And the Arsenal TV director helpfully didn't show that part of the Arsenal attack, only the aftermath with Fabregas scoring. So I think it took a long time for people to realise what happened.
But the players could see there was someone down on the field.
Yeah, but that's okay, because they were in control. It was the same move. It wasn't as if there was a head injury, and it's up to the referee now to stop the game. He didn't. As Wenger said, and I think you have to support them there, they themselves suffered when Danielson went down against Everton, even though Everton didn't score and played on. So I have sympathy for Coyle, but I don't think he can use that as an excuse.
Mm. It was a tackle so bad that even Arsene Wenger saw it. So.
But I mean, the complaint from Bolton was that the ball wasn't put out of play, but the players only have themselves to blame for this, because so many players go down feigning injury now that... It's just, you just don't know if someone's injured or not.
Mm.
Personally, I think unless you hear the snap of a breaking leg, don't put the ball out of play.
They did I think put all this thing of by putting it in the net.
Yeah, well, you know what I mean. But this thing of putting the ball out of play and then giving it back, it's just a complete nonsense. There's no need for it.
All right. Meantime, Arsenal gone top of the table, of course. Mm. Very, very exciting. They've got some players coming back. Gael Clichy, of course, Rosicki, who scored a fantastic goal, and Fabregas already. They do have a very tough run of games coming up. Who we got? Aston Villa, then Manchester United, then Chelsea away, then home to Liverpool. So that's going to be testing. And they're also at Stoke this weekend in the FA Cup, which could provide them with one or two knocks and niggles. Interesting post here from Green Mile, who posted indeed before Arshavin's rather special goal in Wednesday's game. He says, if Berbatov is useless and a waste of space, what about Arshavin, who has scored three times in his last 17 games for Arsenal, managing six league goals in total, managing to set up just one of Arsenal's other 49 league goals this season? Is he the new Sergei Rebrov? Says Greenwell, as I say, before Arshavin there on Wednesday. But does Wenger, this is what Greenwell was saying, does he get away with Arshavin basically freeloading much of the time whilst Sir Alex Ferguson is pilloried for spunking all that cash on Berbatov?
I don't think so. I think for a start, Arshavin was absolutely brilliant last season when he first arrived. And I think he's one of the few players in the Premier League who are genuinely exciting to watch. He hasn't been at his best in recent games, but he's still playing reasonably well. And I think he's a decent player.
He only cost a third of what Berbatov cost, and he's always playing. Mm. If even Fergie doesn't trust Berbatov to play regularly, start regularly, that shows you just how poorly he's been doing, really, measured by the expectation that he brought with him when he made that move from Spurs.
Well, that's enough about the midweek action. Hey, in part two, we're going to be starting a full and frank roundup of all the continental thrills and spills, starting with the Bundesliga.
Football Weekly from The Guardian, in association with SportingBet.com.
Raphael Honigstein, I put it to you, the things are rather exciting there in the Bundesliga since the restart from the big winter break.
They are.
Woof. Bayer Leverkusen top, but only 1 point clear of Schalke. Kevin Kerenyi, he's on fire. And what about Bayern Munchen, who did go top, and now they're 2 points behind?
You said fuff there. Is that German for fuff? Woof?
No, fuff is a number, I think, isn't it, probably?
Fünf.
Yeah.
Right, okay.
Very big games this weekend.
Yes.
None bigger than Bremen against Bayern. Bremen have been very, very poor. They lost against Frankfurt. Bayern have been quite good. And they will welcome back Franck Ribéry.
Oh, yeah.
He might not start. He hasn't had 90...
How many months has he been out?
Well, he hasn't played for 90 minutes since September. He's had sort of only bit parts. I don't think he'll start, but he'll play at some stage. And it's the first time that Tim and Robin also played together for a long time. So people in Munich, very optimistic, of course, about his return, etc. Also, a lot of enthusiasm about Dortmund's return to form. They are really in with a shout, perhaps not for the title, but they could make it into the Champions League again, which would be a fantastic achievement for them. And they got Hamburg at home, which would really be a good game as well on Saturday.
Hamburg
night.
Are just above them in the table.
Yeah.
Excitingly.
The other really interesting news about midfielders.
Even more interesting than all that.
Even more interesting than that is that Torsten Frings, good old Torsten, the man who used to have a raccoon pet called Billy. Once,
what happened to Billy?
Billy had to go
he got
when he
turned
moved
into a hat.
When he moved to Bremen, I think he had to get rid of him. He won't be picking up any pets in South Africa because he's not allowed to go. Yogi Löw has said no, I don't want you anymore. It's been coming for a while. He's been pushed to the side without any real. With any real clear indication of what's going to happen, but always suspected that he was going to get really bad news. And he said now he's not surprised.
Speaking of coming for a while,
Jimbo's not even listening to you. He just wants to crowbar
in. I don't. I wanted to come to you.
Yes.
Is all this because Frings ain't what he used to be?
Yes, that's what Yogi Löw thinks.
Surely Frings can only get better.
that's not what Jogi Löw thinks. He thinks that Frings will never be the same again. It's a bit of a shame because, you know, he's 33. Balak still rates him very, very highly. He's his sort of left-hand man, right-hand man on the pitch. You really would have wanted him to be on the pitch with him. Instead, we're going to have somebody fairly young.
Right, okay, cool. To do all the left-hand, right-hand.
Exactly,
right.
Yes.
Okay.
So a new, younger version of Torsten
Frings. Right, okay, Generalist says, does the pod know why the Bundesliga is not an equal to the English, Italian or Spanish leagues in terms of quality? Given that Germany is in the centre of the European Football Knowledge Network, has dozens of clubs over 100 years old, is one of the richest countries in the world, has a consistently high-performing national team, and has the largest average crowds in continental Europe for its domestic matches, it just doesn't seem right.
I don't know if that's the case. I never watched the German league,
yeah,
and it's never captured my imagination, mainly
why?
Because, well, there's never been the sort of equivalent of a U, you know. I would have had no interest in Italian football, except when I was a kid, I used to watch your quirky
Italian
little show on Saturday mornings.
Yeah, Italian football has always had a certain aura around it, as indeed Spanish does now, that I don't think the Bundesliga has ever really been able to flaunt, no?
But is that just because people assume it mustn't be much good because it's never on TV over here?
No, it is on TV a lot now. But
well, not it's never been, say, on a Channel 4 or like Italian.
But I think that's because the clubs have never wowed people in the way that would draw people to that league. I'm not sure. Raphael,
one reason is, of course, lack of success in the Champions League.
Right.
I mean, in the mid-90s, where Bayern were winning it and Dortmund, and there were a lot of UEFA Cup successes. And in 97, Schalke won the UEFA Cup. Dortmund won the Champions League. Things were different, and also you had a real big, strong rivalry between Bayern and Dortmund. At the moment, you don't really have that. It's always Bayern and somebody else. So, you know, when you look at Italy, you know who your top teams are. You look at Spain, you know who your top teams are. You look at the Premier League, you know instantly two or three teams.
You don't have a regular cast of characters.
So, well, exactly. And when people say they love the Premier League abroad, of course, they only watch the games of the Big Four. No one ever sees Bolton v Burnley in Malaysia, etc. So the success, when you talk about the success of these big leagues, it's always about the success of the two, three teams who really get the following and get all the attention. And Germany has a problem of only having Bayern, and by themselves, they're not able to do it.
Right.
Quite.
On the subject of English views, it might possibly be because the Bundesliga is seen as being too similar to the domestic product, whereas what excites people about the Liga or Serie A, that kind of thing, is the fact that it's all Latin and a bit more exotic.
Yeah,
but the poster was actually asking, and not, you know, why is it popular or not, but is it equal in terms of quality? And if not, why not?
It's very difficult to measure the quality of a league unless you just take a UEFA statistical view and say, you know, these are all the results of all the teams and this is where you stand, and Germany at the moment are just behind Italy in fourth place.
Yeah.
But I think you're right. I mean, they should be doing better. Clearly, they're the biggest nation, and we are the biggest nation in Europe. We have great, great clubs. But the interesting thing, you know, when it comes about the brand is, of course, now that, yeah, I think you're absolutely right, that they've always suffered from being seen as not exotic enough or not foreign enough. Now, though, what's happening is that increasingly it's become seen as a sort of a true, authentic way of football, with fans being able to have
build
a say their
own
in
stadium.
The clubs and build their own stadium and stand in their stadium, have sausage and drink beer, and it's all very cheap. And that's now becoming suddenly very attractive. And there's a number and a growing number of people from the UK who actually travel to Dortmund and start following Dortmund because they say, I'm going from Luton and it's cheaper for me to go see a game in Dortmund than going down to Chelsea or whatever, or to Liverpool and watch a game there.
That sounds fantastic day out, isn't it? And you get sausage and everything.
Yes.
What's the match day experience like in Ligue 1 then, Paul?
Oh,
some sort of pastry delight and chèvre on top?
Yeah, an éclair maybe, I don't know.
Oh. And, yes, anyway, how the Ligue 1, things are very exciting there as well. I noticed that Bordeaux are romping away with it, and the usual suspects are nowhere to be seen. You've got the likes of Lille and Montpellier. What's going on?
Yeah, well, Montpellier are the delight of the season. They were only promoted last season, on the last day of last season, they got into second spot in Ligue 2. And Last night they beat Lens for the first time in their history to cement a second spot in Liga. And they're 23 points clear of relegation, but their manager is still insisting that survival is their only aim. It's great because they've come up and they're just playing attacking football. They just attack home and away. And that's brought them success, even though it hasn't actually brought them that many goals. They've won a lot of matches. And as I think I mentioned before, it's the same team that got them promotion when René Girard, who's the manager, and he's an interesting guy in his own right, because he was out of work for a long time. Just he owned a news agent, and he was working news agent until Aimé Jacquet, the guy who guided France to World Cup success in 1998, persuaded him to become part of the French FA's technical setup. So he worked with underage teams there for a while, and then replaced when Raymond Domenech became manager of the senior team. He replaced Domenech as head of the under 21s. Didn't last particularly long there because he didn't have much success. So again, found himself out of work. And then just last summer, Montpellier appointed him as manager. And it's been a tremendous success with, as I say, the team that got promotion last year, which was with a lot of unknown youngsters and a sprinkling of journeymen from whom no one expected anything much. But they've gelled really well in this 4-3-3 formation that he sticks to rigidly. And as I say, just attacks home and away, and they're great to watch. And they're second in the table. It is quite close up there, so I wouldn't bank on them getting into the Champions League just yet.
I was curious. Are we going to see them in Europe, do you think?
As I say, the manager is still talking about just avoiding relegation. Yeah. But it would be magnificent if we saw them in Europe. They'd probably require a degree of investment to make any inroads there. But it's great fun.
Well, as you say, there's a crowd of teams ganging up to take their top position away from them. Well, second from top. You've got Marseille, Lyon, Monaco and Auxerre all there on 36 points. 3 points behind second place, Montpellier and Bordeaux there, who are themselves 8 points clear of Montpellier in first place. Now, what kind of continental roundup would this be if we didn't hear from our man Sid in Madrid? Hello. And there he is. Hello, Sid. How are you?
I'm very well, thanks. How are you?
Great, great. What are you going to tell us about this week? Guardiola and his contract extension that isn't a contract extension?
Yeah, a very, very bizarre situation. And I think it's a situation that if you analyse it and you start reading the lines, you see so many other factors coming into play. Ooh. And the first one really is that basically yesterday's was a public gallery event. This is a situation in which Guardiola has supposedly renewed his contract, but he hasn't actually renewed his contract at all. What he's done is he's come out and he said publicly, I will continue for another year, but nothing's been signed yet. It will be signed with a new president. So, of course, there's still that question mark of what if the new president doesn't want him to continue? Now, we all know that he will want Guardiola to continue, and the key factor was Guardiola saying, yes, I want to carry on. But to say that the two big caveats are that nothing's been signed yet, and it's only 1 year extension anyway. And what Guardiola said in the press conference, I think, was very interesting and says so much about the pressure that he's under and everything that flies around with Barcelona. He basically admitted in the press conference that he only did it to get everyone to shut up. I mean, rather than standing there and saying, I want to be at Barcelona for a long time, he could just as easily have stood up behind the table and said, will you lot all please just shut your gobs? I've had enough of this. Mm. Leave me alone. Let me get on with my work. That was the key factor.
Right. It's interesting because when you think of managers under pressure, you'd imagine it'd be the type of Benitez at Liverpool or Ferrara at Juventus. People really, really struggling. But this man has just done what no manager's ever done before. He's at his hometown club. He is a deity for the fans. Where does the pressure come from, Sid?
Well, that's exactly where it comes from. That's the whole thing. And Pep Guardiola has basically really screwed up by winning everything in his first season for his hometown club. Now, there's a number of factors in here. The first one is that as he well knows, Barcelona is an extremely political club. And it's an extremely political club that's going to go into presidential elections this summer. So that could be messy. He also knows that he's got the fact that he's won everything last year that it could be to win. And it's impossible to repeat that. In fact, we already know that they won't repeat it, of course, because they've been knocked out of the Copa del Rey. So there's the pressure of that. There's a pressure of trying to live up to something that's basically impossible to live up to. There's also the pressure, as you pointed out, that this is his club. Bear in mind that Pep Guardiola lived about 100 metres from the Camp Nou. He was a ball boy for Barcelona. He was Barcelona's captain. He's very committed to that whole thing of Barcelona's being a Catalan flagship, the whole thing of identity and so on. And that is the key reason why it puts so much pressure on him. personally. And he loads himself with pressure with a desire to always do things well. You only need to look at the difference in the amount of hair he's got between now and 18 months ago when he took over the job. The fact that he looks slimmer, the fact that he puts absolutely everything into this job. There's a really high burnout factor. And so that's the pressure. And then the reason why he did this press conference was because the pressure was from everybody else, pretty much getting on their knees and going, please, please stay. Don't leave us. We're nothing without you. And there's some fantastic footage of Guardiola at a concert in Barcelona. And this, I can't honestly remember who the band was now. And the band's playing away, and then they stop off one of the songs, and they notice that he's in the audience, and they start appealing with him to stay while he's supposed to be at a concert, relaxing, getting away from this kind of thing. So I think he felt that it was getting too much. He felt that the media was using this too much. He also wanted to stop people talking about things like Manchester United and so on.
I want to know where that YouTube footage is, Sid. What should I look for?
Good question. I saw it on Spanish TV, so I don't know if it's on YouTube or not. But
Guardiola,
I suppose if you type in Guardiola and concierto or something like that, you might get it. And
if producer Pete finds it, I'm sure he'll post it up at the top.
Hey, producer
Pete, he's nodding.
Yeah. Also, what you have to remember in all this, again, as I said at the start, it's a one-year extension. In a way, this doesn't change the question mark about could Guardiola be lined up for a foreign club? Hmm. Could Guardiola move on? Because it would still only be if he fulfills this one-year extension, which of course still depends on the new president and on Guardiola still wanting to do so in the summer, it could be that it would still only be a three-year stint at Barcelona. And as I say, Guardiola sees Barcelona as a club with a huge burnout factor. He also has an intention at some stage to go and live and work abroad, and I know that he would absolutely love to go to London at some stage. So I'm not sure that in the medium and long term that this necessarily changes a huge amount.
Yeah. All right then. Coltrane 27 says, can you possibly ask Dr. Sid to praise Valencia? They were fantastic again on Saturday, beating Villarreal 4-1. Ever Banega's been absolutely brilliant for them this season. I'd love to see him go to the World Cup. Perhaps Veron is the problem there. Praise Valencia, Sid.
Brilliant. Absolutely brilliant. Scoring loads of goals. They're a great side to watch. They're only 3 points behind Real Madrid now. They've done this kind of quietly, and they've got the best away record in the league. If they hadn't dropped stupid points at home, they would be right on the tail of Barcelona. They've had three draws this year that have all been blown in the last 5 or 10 minutes of games when they're completely, utterly dominated. And I think they're a very, very good side indeed. As for Ever Banega, he's been brilliant, which is something of a surprise.
Sid, thank you very much for that. Big games this weekend?
Well, in truth, it's not a particularly exciting lot. It's the last game of the first round of the season, so it'll be officially the end of the first half of the season when everyone's played everyone once. Barcelona go away to Valladolid and looking to not lose that game, and that would mean an entire half of the season without being beaten. Ooh. I suppose the exciting one, in a way, is Getafe against Atletico Madrid, the derby of the south of Madrid. That could be quite good fun.
Well, excellent. Perhaps we'll hear about that on Monday, then.
Hope so.
Thank you, Dr. Sid.
Speak to you then. Cheers.
Now, I'll tell you where there are some very exciting fixtures coming up this weekend, and that is, Barry, in Serie A. Yep, you got the Milan derby on the Sunday, 4-0 to Inter last time, but everybody's predicting that Milan are going to get revenge, even Roberto Mancini, former Inter manager, Carlo Ancelotti, saying, oh, this is going to be Milan's, and no Pato, he's flown off to Brazil to cure himself, so Beckham is expected to retain his place in the side for the Derby della Milanina, Maddalena.
You've just done, there's a couple of posters on the...
Yeah.
The blog have commented that you appear to have developed a speech impediment. And I noticed on Monday that you were increasingly starting to sound like Steptoe the Elder in Steptoe and Son.
Right.
And I'm just wondering where this has come from.
Steptoe the Elder. For foreign listeners, listeners outside
I'm
the UK.
Really?
Did he speak that way? I don't remember that. I remember Harry H. Corbett saying, you dirty old man.
Yeah. But oh, sorry.
That's the younger one.
Sorry.
Well, that's not how I'm speaking, for goodness sake. Now, David Beckham will be retaining his place in the Derby della Madonnina, even though Seedorf's back available. So well done, David Beckham. Paul.
A friend of mine played for the Republic of Ireland under-15s in the European Championships many years ago and played against Holland, whose star man was Clarence Seedorf. And before the match, everyone already knew that this guy, Seedorf, was an outstanding player. And as it happens, my friend was delegated to mark him. And my friend was quite a tough character. So he eyed him up as the teams were marching out onto the pitch and made gestures to suggest, you're mine, you're going down or whatever. And before the match even kicked off, as my chum turned around to give instructions to the Irish goalkeeper or whatever, Seedorf wandered into the Irish half, pulled back the neck of my chum's shirt and spat down on his back.
Excellent. There you go.
That's what stars are made of.
Yeah. Nice one. Anyway,
it was 0-0 the match, if you want to know.
Right.
It's the old Frank Rijkaard routine.
Indeed. Anyway, now there's 6 points between Milan and Inter at the top of the table, but Milan have a game in hand, and of course if they beat Inter in the derby, then that would really set up an exciting title race. Now, also this weekend on the Saturday, Juventus, who are keeping faith with Ciro Ferrara as their manager, largely because Gus Hiddink has apparently said, no, thanks, don't fancy that. And they are hosting Roma, who are flying along, who roared into third place. Juve, as we mentioned on Monday, have dropped out of the Champions League positions. They've signed Antonio Candreva, who some posters were asking about, from Livorno. Livorno apparently thinking to replace Candreva with Freddie Ljungberg, who's now at Seattle. But anyway, Candreva's regarded as a bit of a hot young thing in Italy. Lippi's already called him up for a friendly against Holland, and he's just 22 years old, but he's regarded as the man who's going to sit in the middle and pull all the strings in the way that, say, Felipe Melo wasn't doing. So that's a huge game for Juventus. For Roma, equally, because there's nothing they'd like more than to inflict some more pain on their northern rivals. And not only have they got Luca Toni, who's been in good form, it's interesting, the fans are calling, in fact, on Claudio Ranieri, the manager, to unleash — the manager was fired by Juventus just at the end of last season — to unleash the trident with Toni and Vucinic and Francesco Totti, who's back for the first time since before Christmas. The Toto attack, in fact, they're calling it. Totti and Toni. Well, there you go. All very exciting. Juve Roma. I mentioned Toto. Very shortly, we're going to be checking out
the rain's down in Africa.
The rain down in Africa.
Brilliant.
Paul Doyle.
Shocking.
Cup of Nations news after this.
Football Weekly from The Guardian, in association with sportingbet.com.
Paul Doyle, Africa. Sunday the quarterfinals start. Angola are taking on Ghana. Ivory Coast, Algeria. Egypt and Nigeria are also through. We don't know who's going to be facing them yet. That's sorted out today. Just hypothetically, imagine you were talking to somebody who hadn't really been paying attention so far. How can you sum up the CAF?
The CAF?
Hmm.
Isn't it called the CAN?
Yeah, the CAN. No, but it's CAF as well.
That's the organising body.
Yeah. Oh, bollocks. How can you sum up the tournament so far?
It hasn't quite hit the heights that I've been hoping for. It's been dramatic, but quality hasn't been that evident. I think Egypt have been by far and away the best team we've seen so far. They've achieved a level of fluency and cohesion that no other team has managed yet. There have been flashes from other teams, but so far Egypt, as you'd expect, since they've won it the last two times and still have the same manager in charge, they are the team to beat. Although I say as you'd expect, but I didn't actually expect it, because they have a lot of key players absent through injury and the like. But I think credit has to go to Hassan Shihata, the manager, because the unit that he has formed continues despite those absentees. The match, the lineup for the last eight will be completed today when we decide or when we see who goes through from the final group. And Cameroon are in danger of missing out. I don't expect them to.
Who should we be excited about watching in the quarterfinals, then, Paul?
Well, I think Nigeria have had plenty of problems, and they don't have a huge amount of creativity in midfield. But up front, they're attackers. Once they get the ball up that far, that they've looked really lively. Peter Odemwingie has been brilliant, as has Chinedu Obasi, and even Obafemi Martins when he came on as a substitute yesterday. And they could potentially face Cameroon in a quarter final. And Cameroon's defence has been quite ramshackle. So that would be a big match between two mighty powerhouses on the continent. And also Gabon. I've been delighted by Gabon's progress. By the time you hear this, they may have been eliminated, but I'm hoping they won't be, because they've been great. And if they are eliminated, there's a chance that Zambia will go through in their place. Algeria by the way, if I can just interject, well, interrupt myself by saying that they've been a disappointment, not entirely unexpected, because I think we thought that their focus would be mainly on the World Cup later this year. But they have qualified by finishing second in their group, level on points with Mali. Mali had a far superior goal difference to them, but it was the head-to-head record that was taken into account. And in the final match, where they knew that a 0-0 draw would suffice for them to progress, they came to a gentle arrangement with Angola to play out a 0-0. And as anyone who remembers in 1982, which Algerians still talk about, when Germany and Austria colluded in much the same way to deny them a place in the World Cup second round, we'll find it all.
Yeah, it's ironic, isn't it? Yeah, he who lives by the gentleman's agreement dies by the... No, he who dies by the gentleman...
is resurrected by the...
Yeah.
Not for long, though, because they're playing Ivory Coast in the quarterfinals, and they will be demolished.
Have you seen anything that would suggest to you that this could be Africa's year as far as the World Cup is concerned? Because there was a lot of talk about the African nations going to be really strong at the World Cup, but I think people might see things a bit differently.
Well, first of all, it's quite frequently in the past, the teams that have qualified for the World Cup don't do well in the African Nations Cup when it's held in the same year. But then the fact that I said that Egypt are by far away the best team in the tournament and they're not in the World Cup is rather sad. I do think one team that will definitely be stronger in the World Cup is Ghana. They're quite weak at the moment because a lot of their main players are absent, and they've given them a chance to a lot of their under-20 players who won the under-20 World Cup last summer. And so if they come to the fore... there'll be nice competition for places for their squad in the World Cup. And also Ivory Coast, because the big thing about them is that they've had a sort of a Tottenham-esque mental weakness in recent years, which has prevented them from achieving what you think they probably should. If they were to finally win the tournament this year, and it would take a huge amount of pressure off their so-called golden generation, and they could go to South Africa with a renewed confidence and composure.
Now, good Lord, we still have so much to discuss, and yet there's so little time left in today's Football Weekly Extra. But let's then crack through the rest. David Sullivan, David Goldin at West Ham. Hammer Keith posting in one day saying, "Whoa, I think we are the luckiest fans in the Premier League at the moment." And then posting in about an hour later saying, "I've now heard the plans for moving to the Olympic Stadium. I'm not happy. It will be horrible. Are they just trying to sell the ground?" Is the future now brighter for the Hammers?
I think it's a bit brighter, but I don't think it's as bright as Sullivan and Gold are making out, or indeed as bright as Sullivan's crushed velvet burgundy smoking jacket, which he appears to have modelled on Hugh Hefner. They've told the fans what they want to hear, and fans, football fans being football fans, I think they've swallowed it hook, line and sinker. Mm. I'd say the chances of West Ham playing in the Champions League within 7 years are somewhere between slim and none.
Good, but the prospect's possibly a little bit better than some of the other stories that were circulating not too long ago of players being sold off and all that. Ooh,
the important person in this story is Crystal Palace chairman Simon Jordan, who some years ago promised to impale himself on one of David Sullivan's dildos if he had to listen to the story of how he's a poor East End Jewish boy done good. And that's come to pass, so my best wishes go out to Simon Jordan. I hope he isn't walking funny for too long.
I hope he enjoys his experience, yes. Okay, good. Now, on to the weekend's action then. Man United are hosting Hull in the Premier League. Will Hull's fans be chanting USA, USA in the way the City supporters apparently were doing midweek? Only time can tell. In the FA Cup, meanwhile, Fulham's injury-ravaged side will be at Accrington Stanley. Preston North End, meantime, are hosting Chelsea, who, as you all know, haven't won at Deepdale since 1962. Preston North End, we had a very exciting poster telling us all about them the other day and their 7-0 victory over Colchester. Of course, Darren Ferguson there. Barry, what do you know about Preston North End?
Well, I know quite a lot now because I spoke to Tony Paley on our racing desk today. He's a dyed-in-the-wool Preston fan. So he's telling me the owner of Preston, who got a lot of grief for sacking Alan Irvine earlier this season, after they went on a bit of a losing streak, and then installed Darren Ferguson, So Trevor Hemmings, the owner, he's more interested in owning racehorses than football clubs. And I think it's his son who sort of runs the show, Preston, and just gets a handout every now and then whenever they need to buy some players. But they've got up front John Park and the Beast, Chris Brown, who many people remember as the cameraman in the famous Sunderland bongo video. And Neil Mellor, who's ex-Liverpool. Tony Paley was really optimistic when he started telling me about Preston, and then the more he went on, it was like a Waldorf and Statler routine done by one man. It was like, yeah, we have a good chance, and then about 2 minutes later, we're going to get stuffed.
Man City are at Scunthorpe. City came a cropper in the League Cup last season to Brighton. Could be another shock on the cards. Or not, I don't know. Arsenal have a tough game away to Stoke. They're always tough games at Britannia, aren't they? Potential for an upset. I'm just looking at Spurs and their game against Leeds United, who, of course, put Man United out.
Leeds have lost the last two in a row.
Well, I know, but maybe the cup is where they come to life.
I think it's a good time to go to Spurs.
Yeah.
Certainly on the back of the Wednesday's capitulation at Anfield. So, why not?
So it's a good time to go to Spurs, and it's a good time to be playing Leeds. So something's got to give.
Right. Good one. Well, that is it for Football Weekly Extra. And we'll be back with Football Weekly on Monday. Many thanks to Paul Doyle. So nice to have you back today. Barry Glendinning. Looking forward to seeing you on Monday if you're around.
Yeah,
lovely. And Raphael Honigstein. Sterling work as ever. Producer Pete, many thanks to you. And thanks for being with us, listeners. We'll be back on Monday, as I just mentioned. See you then.
Football Weekly Extra from The Guardian, in association with sportingbet.com.